Welcome to Beef and Lamb New Zealand's Seen and Heard podcast for September 2017. These podcasts, which are audio, not visual, and I'll explain that in joke later on with our guest who's looking very disappointed after having tidied himself up to be on camera. They're a key part of our extension activities now, and I just wanted to talk a wee bit about that at the start before we get into tonight's speaker. So extension is the process of supporting successful behaviour change, or at least that's how Beef and Lamb talk about it. It's not just achieving change for the sake of it. And in Beef and Lamb New Zealand, we sometimes describe our role as helping farmers make informed business decisions, which I quite like because making a decision means taking action. And I think in the sheep and beef industry at least, and we'll talk a wee bit more about this actually later on, we've been pretty good about people becoming aware of ideas or hearing about them, but not so good about people actually putting them into practice. There's lots of opportunities out there. It's just a chance of people actually seizing them. So there is a bit of a slogan and extension as well, which says that farmers learn best from other farmers. Now, leave aside that learning isn't the same as doing, which is just what I've been talking about. People have learned a lot of stuff but haven't actually necessarily put into place. That's both a valuable saying in that the experience of those who walk the walk is very powerful, but it's also overvalued a wee bit in that we need the right context. It doesn't just happen. It's not necessarily true for every farmer in every situation, and it's not the answer by itself. Otherwise, we could leave things to happen, and farmers talking over at the fence or the golf club or the pub would get the messages done. So the other key issue, of course, that some of the research has found is not every farmer will give good advice necessarily. So what they tell you may not necessarily be true. So that may sound like a bit of an odd introduction, given our guest tonight is a farmer. But one of the reasons why we have these podcasts now is to get connected to more farmers, so they pick up the information through the podcast. It provides the information in another format that might suit people better. But it also means we can leverage, if you like, to use a bit of a buzzword, from people who can't be everywhere, but that we know lots of people would like to hear from. So on that note, that explains why he's here tonight. Welcome to the podcast, Steve Wynne-Harris.
Thank you very much, Aaron. Thanks for asking me.
You're most welcome. And we're running a wee bit late tonight. Now, not that those of you listening on the podcast will know, but we've had a few issues with the technology. So we'll see how tonight goes, but hopefully we've got a good recording here. So we'll do the introductions in just a minute, but I've told you what we were going to do, so now I'm going to throw it out the window and do something completely different. So do you consider yourself a successful farmer? And what's success to you in farming?
Well, isn't it? I think there's some old research, Beef and Lamb research or somewhere, that something like 80% of the farmers thought that they were in the top 80%, so I'm probably one of those ones. So I think I do okay, but I went off to Lincoln and got myself an agricultural degree and did DOE and was a hippie in Asia and came back, and my father suddenly up and took off, and so I had, it was fairly traumatic at the time, I had to borrow money. And started farming the day that subsidies stopped, so they were tough years to have a lot of debt, and that certainly formed the way that I've farmed. And I was, looking back, a very poor farmer, because no agricultural degree was really going to equip me to be a decent farmer. So I either had to learn to be good, or I was going to go broke. So I probably ended up okay now, but those early years were probably a bit ropey.
So we've asked this of other farmers that have been on. What is success to you in your farming career?
Well, what's always driven me, well, in those early years, was not to go broke through the 80s and into the 90s. But what I've never been driven by money. Money doesn't interest me. But whatever I do in life, I always want to be the best I can be. So it's trying to better myself. And I'm a competitive bugger too. And we might talk about discussion groups, but, you know, I was in a discussion group, and early on, you know, I said, I want to be Hawke's Bay Farm of the Year, and they all laughed, and I said, well, that's one of my goals, I'm going to set that. And I got there, it took me I was a finalist 5 years in a row. And then these other fellas, that became their goal, and several of them also achieved that. So going back to your question, it's just, you know, I'm just driven by being as good as I can be. I mean, that doesn't always work well. I mean, I'm a golfer and I'm a terrible golfer, but I keep trying there. But probably sheep and beef farming, dryland farming, I've ended up being, you know, pretty good at it. And it's probably one thing I am reasonably good at. And luckily that's the thing that earns our living. And because of just trying to be really good, money flows from that. So, you know, in fact, we've been very profitable in sort of the last 10 or 15 yep. years. So, but that hasn't been my driver.
But we do want to drill into a bit of that stuff tonight because, it may not be the driver for every farmer either, but it certainly makes a lot of the other stuff easier to achieve, I guess, if you're all that stuff about hard to be green if you're in the red and that sort of thing. One thing you are good at, Steve, is being a communicator. So there's probably a large number of farmers who are listening to this all around the country who are at least aware of some of your work through media articles and some that have listened to you on the radio and stuff. But so we know a bit about what goes day to day. But you talked a bit about when and how you came onto the farm. What's the family history and your sort of history before that in terms of how you got to the Wynne Harris has always been on this?
Well, you know, there's a big debate in New Zealand and New Zealand agriculture about foreign ownership. My mum was a Christchurch school teacher. We'd often do her OE on the ship in those days in the late 50s. Met my English father. He was going back, having done his OE, pre-pill, so they got married pretty promptly. And I was born 9 months later in London. And then my sister Susanna was born there as well. And then they emigrated, the four of us emigrated back to New Zealand, where my mother's family was. My father was a London policeman, and he had a hankering to be a farmer because he'd stood on the back of Land Rovers in Australia and shot kangaroos, and he thought, if that's farming, I'm going to do a bit of that. And so we ended up here in Central Hawke's Bay on a small farm, 180 hectare, 450-acre farm, which is the basis of where I started. We've since I've been there, we've doubled that area. And I got brought up. We came when I was two or three, so I've never felt like a Pom. And when we play the Poms or the Aussies, and, whether it's rugby or netball or whatever, I'm very keen that New Zealand wins, so don't worry about my allegiances there. Brought up with another two siblings born here. So went to the local school, St. Hawke's Bay College, and as I said, went off to Lincoln after that.
So do you... The objective background then, you said you've doubled the size of the farm. How big is it now? What are you running on the place?
Okay, so nowadays it's 360 hectares. So I leased 120 hectares when I bought the farm in 1985, the original one. We had 130,000 of equity. My wife Jane and I had only just got married. She's from Middlemarch down there in central Otago. And I leased another 300 acres because the option was to go to the works or find another or farm job. And Jane remained as a school dental nurse because we needed the income. Mm-hmm. And in those days, I think it was about 30K was quite a big salary. And so we put off having kids. So I'm 58 now, and we've only just had our youngest leave home last year. So we delayed having children because of the goals of paying off some debt and remaining on the farm.
Yep. So what are you running on that land?
Oh, you did ask me that. So I've got 1,500 ewes. Then we'll talk about sheep production later. Usually about 400 ewe hoggets, a couple of hundred ram hoggets, and cattle. My cattle is my flexible part of the operation. I started farming bull beef 32, 33 years ago because I couldn't actually afford to buy steers and heifers, so bulls were cheap, a cheap option when I started farming. And they can range, I think in 2007 after a particularly nasty drought, I wintered 30 or 40. The following year I restocked and I might have had 350 or 400 or 450. So they are my flexibility, they pure trading stock. Yep. And they come and they go, and sometimes I'm not even, if it's an autumn drought, I'm not able to kill them and I will sell them, store, to protect my capital stock, my ewes and my hoggets.
So you're talking about drought and dryland, what... rainfall, typical range.
So we're here, and we're doing this interview in Waipukurau, so Central Hawke's Bay. I'm about 20 k's out of town, 15 minutes out of town, and a very variable climate here. My last rainfall I've recorded is around about 500 mils, and it was the next year, I think, can't remember the exact years, might have been 1990 or something. It was 1,200 mils. So, you know, that's been the range in my time. And autumn, we've had a series of autumn droughts in 07, 8 and 9, and of course lots of drought. I mean, it's like a litany. 1983, 86, 89, 94, 98, I can remember them all. Although nowadays they're blending into one a bit. So the autumns, which used to be very reliable, become unreliable. Although, you know, it looked like we were set up for another autumn drought following a summer drought this year, and it turned into probably the best autumn that I've ever experienced in the wettest winter. So it's certainly... a volatile climate. So the trick is you know, as everyone listening knows, you've just got to have those flexible options. Mm. You have to be light on your feet, and you have to make timely decisions.
So give us an idea of sort of season. When do you normally lamb up here?
I start lambing in early August. Yep. Synchronise the ewes. I've just come through this period. I'm a bit knackered physically, actually. It's getting harder nowadays. Because I haven't pointed that out. I'm a one-man band, 3,500 stock units, and do a few things off-farm as well. So it's quite physical. So we start in early August. I've synchronised the ewes, so it's very rapid, and probably by mid-August I'm shedding and docking, you know, by the sort of 20th to the 25th of August. I've just finished all my docking. And the lates, you know, the last couple of lates at lamb, and the hoggets are just kicking in now. The ewe hoggets are starting to lamb.
That's tailing for the audience.
Tailing, sorry, to you South Islanders.
And look, one of the other key numbers people often talk about with your farm is trees and subdivision. So how many paddocks and how many trees have you planted in
your farm? Well, I've more than doubled my number of paddocks. And my average size is, I'm on easy rolling to just, you know, hill country with a bit of flat. But my average paddock size is a ridiculous 2.5 hectares. I'm either a bit like a dairy farmer trapped on a dry land sheep and beef farm or an intensive Southland farm on this dry hill country here in Hawke's Bay. So, yeah, small paddocks. I retired all my steeper land classes into forestry, fortunately, 28 to 30 years ago.
Good time.
And I'm about to have my first big harvest in 2 or 3 months. And that was planted... Actually, it wasn't a conservation reasons at that stage, although I did identify that as my poor performing country. But it was we had so much debt then I couldn't see my way, and prices were so poor through the '80s. So I did this planning in sort of 1990, 1991, 1992. That was going to be how we were going to retire debt, or take some money from out of the farm if we had a successor coming in. Been steadfast about retiring debt, and you know, I've got a national reputation for being one of the meanest people in the country. But that was because I spent no money on myself, driven old, until recently, old clapped out cars. You know, I had a Mitsubishi Lancer for 15 years and then a clapped out ute for the next 15 years. And you know, we haven't had boats or batches or expensive holidays. So, you know, every spare dollar was a hostage, and it was for debt repayment. Yep. And again, I think that's because I was a product of those 1980s, you know, when the subsidies suddenly got stopped. I mean, I didn't have any subsidies, but the people, you know, I looked at, you know, who'd farmed through the 70s had some good years, they had some good climate years, and then they had that period of subsidies, and then they were the ones that probably found it harder because the tap just got turned off.
Although I think you may have inferred it or referred to it, but just to be precise, you didn't just not coincide with subsidies. It was actually a pretty...
Well, I started farming the day that they were taken away. Mm-hmm. But I knew that when I was borrowing the money and setting up that wasn't going to be the case. So I planted that forestry. There's about 30-odd hectares, so 10-12% of my farm is in forestry. And as I say, 15 hectares goes out in a couple of months' time, which I'm not looking forward to because it's going to make a hell of a mess of my farm. But at the moment, forestry returns are pretty looking good.
Okay, look, so we've done this, some of the more prosaic stuff, just to give people who don't know a bit of a background, and we are going to dig into some of this and we'll refer back to some of these. But what we always let people do, and Steve, you're no exception, is the elevator pitch at the start, or the take-home messages. If there's three things, or four, or five, or one, that you would like, or you've learned, or you want others to remember, or take away.
Yeah, well,
it's your chance to hit them.
I would imagine that the people who listen into these sort of things are not the people who get sucked into snake oil and charlatans and things like that. I mean, that really frustrates me that there is still a good living for these people and for those ideas. I guess we call it fake news nowadays, but I've always believed in what farm consultants and scientists have said. And told me. I mean, they're not infallible either, but I've pretty well followed the recipes that you know, either learnt at Lincoln or for the countless field days and the countless articles that I've read. So I've followed science, and in my case, it's proven to have worked really well. And I guess, you know, you're thinking of, you know, what are those the three things? So it's like I see it, my farming career and my farming operation as a three-legged stool. Uh-huh. So you got the soil fertility, and I started off with Olsen peas of 11 or 12, and it was very difficult to put capital fertiliser on financially in those early years. But sometimes in my career, You needed you only needed three or four lambs, depending on what the value of a lamb was, per tonne of super phosphate. Other times it's been 10 or 12 lambs per tonne of phosphate. So I really made use of those times when, you know, I was either doing better or super phosphate was cheaper. Anyway, I've got my Olsen P levels up into that 25 to 30 range. And in terms of that fertiliser application, it's like, I've always seen it as like filling up a bucket with a whole lot of holes on the side, and you're not going to get past the first hole until you've plugged it. So in my case, on my soils, and in most people's cases in the country, it was phosphate. And because it's super phosphate, that's addressing the other hole that's just near it, which is sulphur. I've lifted my P levels a lot, but sulphur's on my soils is difficult to lift. So you know, that becomes, you know, an annual input. And then there's a hole much further up, well, further around on the other side of the bucket is pH. So my pHs used to be 5.5 and they're now in the low sixes. So you address that, and I'm very fortunate to live just near Hartuma Limeworks, and you know, they've got a good product, very handy to me, so the cost of cartage is very modest. And then there's a hole much further up is potassium. So, you know, it took a long time before I needed to start addressing that, because I'm still, you know, Olsen P's of 15. I didn't need to worry about any of the micronutrients. And in recent years, a bit of selenium and molybdenum. And that's taken me my whole career before I started dabbling with some of the things that I see salesmen touting to people whose Olsen P's are 12. You know, just get with the science. Correct the limiting.
Is it a nutrient? Instead of talking about your soils, but are you a selenium deficient area?
You get a little bit through the dredges, and then that's in and out, doesn't work. And I have a B12 issue on one property, on the home property. I have to use B12 from that young stock in the growthy autumns. Well, I use it in all autumns now through long acting injections, because it's about monitoring my manganese. It took a long time to find out why the stock on that farm wouldn't do as well as the farm 5Ks down the road. Same genetics, same manager. Two different farms, and it turned out that this other farm had a very high manganese level, which was locking up the cobalt that was there. When you tested for it, it was there in the soil and in the clover, but it wasn't accessible to the stock. And I was getting, in a particular year, and I think in the late 80s, classic bush, you know, cobalt deficient symptoms, weepy eyes, ill thrift, shitty, shelly sheep. But not looking for cobalt deficiency, because I'm not on the ash soil, so, you know, like up on the central plateau. But that's what it was through high manganese. So I guess, that, you know, there's a little thing. Knowledge is power. You know, do some monitoring. Find out if there's something that's troubling you. Usually it's the obvious thing, but in this case it was something that wasn't obvious. So that's soil fertility. And if you're going to get your soil fertility up, and you don't harvest the feed that you've grown, you've just wasted a shitload of money. Are we allowed to say shitload on this thing?
Yeah, yeah. Not none of your fancy radio shows or anything like that.
So you've got to put in subdivision. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. And sometimes you can even put the subdivision in ahead of lifting the fertility levels. In fact, that's what I did. So that you're getting good control, and you can do decent rotational grazing. You know, I still am staggered by the amount of set stocking I see. You know, we know that you're going to grow 15 or 20% more feed if you rotationally graze, and you know, that's what the clover and the ryegrass pastures require. So get your subdivision in, and as I say, mine's ridiculous, and means I'm always moving stock, but they will come on a call, and, you know, I don't need too many dogs. And then so look after your ryegrass clover swards, or try to encourage them. And, of course, if you're going to do subdivision, you've got to put in an effective water system. And I'm lucky I've got spring-fed creeks, which I pump out up onto tanks, and then gravity feed back to troughs. So other people, like out from the coast from here, are more limited in their water resources and rely on dams, and are probably precluded from doing the sort of intensifying that I've done. But I've got a good access to good quality water. So that's my first thing, is the soil fertility. Second thing is genetics, you know. Doesn't matter whether we're talking sheep or cattle or what breed you've got, but we've got the tools there now through SIL to identify really good genetics. You know, so if your ram breeder is telling you that the ears are sticking up in the right way and the shoulder's got a nice look about it, and they get a new ram breeder. Go to a ram breeder who's using SIL and is transparent, shows you their records. Plenty of breeders use SIL, but a little hesitant about full disclosure. Put some pressure on these guys and, you know, ask hard questions. You know, you're paying good money for rams or bulls, you know, if it's guys with cow heads. So get good genetics. You go on the SIL website. That's a great resource that Beef and Lamb has. Go there. You can have a look at all of our stud breeders. You know, I should disclosure. I've got a Kirkwood, male Kirkwood stud myself, but I'm just talking about look at right across all the different breeds and look at all the different stud breeders and you can see, you know, is this guy just a bullshitter or does he have good genetics? So and those tools are getting better and better with SIL. So get good genetics because you're not going to if you've got bloody average genetics, you're not going to lift your game. No matter how good your pastures are. That's the second thing. And then third, of course, is management. So you've got to bring it all together and make good use of that improved soil fertility and the good genetics that you've now got. And I'm great when it's spending other people's money. So your management's got to lift. You've got to lift your game there. And again, I imagine the people who are listening to this, who've bothered to listen to this, you know, are doing all these sort of things anyway. But, you know, so your allocation of feed, and that comes from your subdivision, but things, you know, like rotational grazing and, you know, just things like understanding leaf area index. Again, we come back to the guys that just set stocking and the pasture stays short all the time and doesn't give the chance, you know, to build up some root reserves when it's needed. And feed budgeting, you know, again, allocation of that feed. I think there's only something like 10 to 15% of sheep and beef farmers' feed budget formally. And surprisingly, something like 30 to 50% of dairy farmers, you know. One assumes that it'd be all the dairy farmers with feed budget, but half of them don't. And you don't even need to use, I mean, I use one of the flash programs, but, you know, you can just use spreadsheet ones or, you know, pinch one off a consultant or borrow one or something like that or even do it on your own spreadsheet. It's just a discipline. I mean, I'm an experienced farmer now, but I'm surprised sometimes when my feed budget tells me to sell stock and I feel like I've got some weeks up my sleeve and I sell it and it's very, very seldom that I think I went too soon. So those predictive powers of a good program outweigh your gut, even for someone like me who's battled numerous droughts. And has had that experience for a long time. So I think what it does is, because I think earlier on I talked about making timely decisions, it forces you to make those decisions that you don't really want to do, you know. Shit, I don't want to sell cattle on a falling market and they're going to be worth a lot more money in the future. I'm driven by keeping my, in the correct pasture height for the different types of the year, rather than the economic outcomes. And again, you know, I've got enough, I always have enough feed at the beginning of lambing because I've got high performance ewes, and if you don't, it's going to be really messy. And so, you know, if you want, you know, an average cover of 14 or 1500 Ks at the 1st of August for when I start lambing, that means at the end of May, you've got to have exactly this, you know, 1800 Ks. And, you know, you're going to have to grow this much and this is your feed demand through the winter. So it's a simple recipe because June and July, as we know, are the variance in the growth rates for June and July. In my case, a tough June and July will be 8 kilograms of dry matter per hectare per day and a really good one will be 12. But usually it's 10 in both months with a little bit of around there. But the month that we're coming up to, October, my ice cream month, can be 18 to 20 in a really windy, dry Hawke's Bay when all, you know, the AMP tents are all blowing down and it does it for the whole month. Or it can be 50 or 60. So, and that month can be a kilo, you know, when it's the 20 kilograms and the month when your feed demand is at 25, really gets you in trouble quick and can't be foreseen. So the winter months are much more predictable and easier to manage. So you do everything you can in May after an autumn drought, you know. In my case, got rid of most of my Friesian bulls, wound down the ones that I've got, put on some nitrogen. I'm not a big nitrogen user, but I use it as it's purely a supplement, and I'll bang it in, you know, once every second year, or every third year sometimes, or maybe it might be every year. And we're talking 30 or 40 units of N, maybe over 280 hectares or something like that, just because I know it will give me that much extra cover. So, we talked about stock sense. And I'm not a great shepherd or stockman. Uh-huh. I've probably got better at that in recent times, but I'm a good pasture manager. Uh-huh. It took me a long time to realise that. You know, we all, as farmers, we all like to think that we're really good with stock and things like that. I mean, I love stock, don't get me wrong. And I love my sheep and my breeding operation. But yeah, I'm a much better pasture manager. I mean, that's quite useful because it does mean you get performance out of the stock. But you know, you've got to have that stock sense and that ability to look after them and make sure they're sound and all of those things. So I guess those are my three, the three-legged stool thing: soil fertility, genetics, and management.
So we're going to drill into some of those, but just like a general question at the start, you talked about how you started your farming career, what your background has been, and where you've come from since then. What's been the key things, not the lessons you've learned, but how you learned, your key mentors or sources of learning some of these things, you know, to get to the point where you are now?
Okay, well, because, you know, I came home and I said my father, and he sort of took off unexpectedly. And because I just didn't have the skills or anything, I had to rely on, lean on other people or go to every field day there was and just try and soak it up. And I formed a discussion group and then joined up with another mate of mine, John Walden, who had an Ashley Clinton discussion group. So we combined the two. And yeah, there was about 15, 18 of us in that. And we were all probably similar situation to me, I suppose. Mm. We were probably the only fellas of that age. You know, we were sort of in our mid-20s. Had opportunities to farm in our own right at a young age, which is a great, great opportunity. But we, you know, we were all at risk of going broke, and some of those guys did, or several of them actually changed careers. You know, sold up. Yep. It was really tough. Sold up and have been successful in other things. So, you know, anyone who's listening who is struggling, I mean, that is always an option, and it's an honourable option. And sometimes it might be the best option if you just cannot get on top of the debt, and it's physically affecting you and it's affecting your family. That's an option that should be considered. But anyway, so we had a good discussion group, and you know, I suppose it was, you know, I was the competitive bugger, I suppose, but the others became competitive, and so we used to do accounts analysis.
And so you also had a facilitator, consultant?
Yeah, we had a different facilitator. We had Ray Guilford, Alan Barr, who became a good mate of mine, who's recently died of leukemia. Who else did we have? Did Roy Fraser do it? I can't remember. Several different consultants. And did the accounts analysis. Mm-hmm. So we were benchmarking, you know, before benchmarking was fashionable. We were benchmarking against each other. So you could see, you know, how come he's doing so well? Mm-hmm. What's driving his business? And we'd, you know, we'd go there. So it was fairly, we'd probably even disclose debt. Maybe it wasn't in the handouts, but we would talk quite openly about what our levels of debt was and things like that. And, you know, and you always had someone to ring up. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think, oh, what do I do next? You'd ring, you know, I'll ring up such and such and ask to pick his brains.
So they weren't, they were far from being just the social club once a month. They were focused.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, we'd probably have a beer afterwards or something. So it was, I mean, and that's really important that, you know, a group of like-minded fellows meeting once a month. Yeah, that, you know, getting, and same as field days. I mean, now I'm disgraced with field days now. I just talk to people and then I go home and think, God, what did I learn? I wasn't listening, I was talking.
Good barbecue at the end.
Yeah, but we're very interested in helping each other and helping ourselves.
You're still in a discussion group now?
Well, then I became a monitor farmer.
Yeah.
So I was one of those for about 4 years, 3 or 4 years. And about that time, the discussion group was winding up. It had been going for about 15 or 16 years. Well, you know, we're all having kids and stuff by that stage, and we're at different schools. And so our lives were going in different. I mean, we're all quite, it's great catching up with those guys whenever I bump into them. And then, yeah, once I finished being a monitor farmer, I was probably busy with other stuff, coaching sports teams and board of trustee chair and all of that stuff. So, yeah, I haven't been involved in a structure like that. But, any young person, I'd not fully encourage it. You know, and if there isn't a discussion group, do what John Walden and I did and form your own discussion group. Get some, you know, get some smart, ambitious people around you. You know, surround yourself with good people, clever people.
Yeah, so it's that farmers learning from farmers thing I talk about. How important was the facilitator in it? Because that's always the look at their bill versus what they're adding to a group.
Yeah, I think when we started, it was probably still math. I think Ray Guilford was probably free, for a year or two or three until the economic reality set in. But Yeah, what was the question?
Oh, I can't remember either. Jesus Christ. No, the facilitator and the role, how important was that?
I think...
The farmers learning from farmers, you were obviously a pretty motivated group, but you were actually paying somebody to...
No, I think because we were quite motivated group, we drove ourselves a bit, so the facilitator was less important whether you had a good or a bad one. But, you know, certainly if you can get a good facilitator and they've got the disciplines, I suppose, you know, they're the one, you know, if they've got the disciplines and they're getting the accounts analysed and getting
sort of
a good handout.
Yep.
Yeah, so they were doing that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, how the discussion groups in my career, there's parts of the country where they're still very strong and other places where they've gone. But one of the things, for those of you that are listening, if that's sort of piqued your interest, that's what RNPP are basically, in a manner of speaking, rediscovered or want to re-energise as the discussion group sort of culture. They call it an action network, but they are very similar to a discussion group, but with some oomph behind them. And part of what RNPP are doing is actually professional development, basically, for facilitators. So there'll be good people out there. You won't be forced to have a certain facilitator, but there'll be plenty to select from. So we'll send out the link to some of these action networks that they're working on at the moment. They've seen that as a real opportunity. So, digging up in some of that. So your dry land farming, you got that variable rainfall, 50,000-odd trees. That's going to be a whole lot to rip out when you put the pivots on, Steve.
You wouldn't talk about irrigation.
Well, talk about your system though. Would irrigation actually? I mean, are you making good money in a dryland environment without putting a pivot on?
Yeah, I mean, 800 mils of rain. Mm. I mean, it would be great to be able to put water on at certain times of the year on specified areas. But I'm rolling hill country, covered in trees. As you say, I've planted some 50 or 60,000 trees. So I ain't ripping them out. I've spent a whole career planting. And when we talked about the forestry, you know, I didn't mention all the nut trees and the shade. Every paddock, in terms of stock welfare, has got shade and shelter. But more importantly, I'm on heavy soil, so I've got a good Matapuro silt loam over heavy clays and then pans, you just can't irrigate. The only cropping I do is brassica cropping, and that is for a little bit of lamb finishing and for summer, for winter cattle, but more as importantly is for regrassing.
Mm. What sort of brassicas?
I've used them all, you know, whatever what am I using at the moment? I can't remember all the names.
But one of the kales
I did use some kales this year and forage brassicas and emerald grape. And, you know, you name it, I've tried. The same with the pasture. I went through all the alternative grass things, trying to find the magic formula.
Yeah, yeah.
So if we're talking about regrassing, you know, I didn't mention that in my little spiel, did I? It's the one thing I'm unconvinced about. You know, I talk to the plant breeders and go, these ryegrasses you sell me, they last, in my environment, under really good management and really good soil fertility. Mm. You know, like I won't graze, you know, if I've got new grass and it's dry and I need to feed, I won't graze them. You know, I do everything I can to keep these things going. And I say, these things only last 4 or 5 years. And they go, well, what do you expect? And I go, well, on the bag it says perennial ryegrass. Mm. And when I went to school, perennial meant forever. And they go, oh, you're dreaming. Well, you know, for hill country and easy hill country farming, things like that, you're not going to be doing 20% of your farm a year.
Hmm.
You know, it's more likely, most of us do 5%. You know, a big year is 10%. Well, 5% is going to take you 20 years to get around your cultivatable place, you know. So, you know, your pastures and they're running out after 5 or 7 or 8 years. So that's a frustration for me. You know,
so
it's
what's
a big spend, $800 a hectare, you know, to get the contractor in.
What are they reverting to or turning into?
A lot of my hills where I haven't cultivated and I've done the old hoof and tooth and the subdivision and lift the pea levels, they are actually ryegrasses and clovers up there, but they're old, you know, they're Hawke's Bay ryes, and they used to be hellish and bad for staggers. But in my breeding program, I breed for facial extra tolerance, and I think I've got some tolerance now to other fungal toxins, and we talk about this in the FE Gold group that I'm in. So there's no science about that, but that's instinctive. It makes sense that if they can process one type of toxin in terms of the facial expert toxin, they could process the other ones. It may be that my management has improved or something, but I don't get the staggers like they used to on these old pastures. But, you know, he asked me what they revert back to. I mean, other types of ryegrass, or I'd see a lot less reversion actually than I used to. Now that you asked the question, you know, they don't go back into old Coxfoots and brown tops and things like that. But the rocket fuel pastures seem to slowly disappear, and taken over by other things.
So annual legumes and things aren't.
No, not really. I've had a program of 20 hectares. I got excited about, I went into red clover and plantain. I've used plantains and chicories forever. I've sort of gone off, I used to have them in the mixes, and then of course that precluded being able to spray out the, you know, wolf thistles that we get here at times, Scotch and Wing and Nodding Thistle. But I did the red clover. We established the red clover first in the spring. This was the technique at the time. It was about 5 or 6 years ago. And it was an Agricom trial. And then spun the plantain on in early autumn when the rains came, and had an established red clover. And that first year put that was my finishing platform, put some pressure on me because I had to nurse this red clover through a dry December, January, February period. So I didn't really get much grazing off it. But the second year it was amazing. Mm. It was fantastic. And I'd asked them about the estrogen in these flesh red clovers, and they go, "Oh, there's no estrogen." I still wasn't prepared to sheep ewes on it, but I had lambs finishing on, and the ewe lambs had udders in January that I could get milk out of, so don't tell me there's no estrogen in them. So be careful if you're tupping on red clover, would be my advice. Second year was great, the third year started to run out, and then last year was the fourth year, so I've decked them and I sprayed them out. And I'm not using red clover again because I noticed how strong it was near my shelter belts, where it was shaded and cooler. And how it just got cooked after 2 or 3 years out in the full heat of the Hawke's Bay sun. So I was just too dry and hot for red clovers. But the plantain, I can grow plantain quite easily. And that, you know, that's promising. So, I mean, the reason I was interested in that trial was it was a 3-year lamb finishing platform. Not such a big contributor through in the winter period. And I wouldn't graze it if it got wet on my wet soils. But I just thought, if you can get a 3-year brassica, you know, for one cost for $850 a hectare, it's a third the cost of a my brassicas tend to be annual brassicas. So, you know, I get a bit of lamb finishing and then shut it up and sometimes put a bit of nitrogen on and then it's my winter platform for cattle. Okay. So, but then I did realise that it also meant I was doing a third less regrassing. So anyway, I've gone back to my annual brassicas.
So with the risk of drought or low rainfall, you talked a bit before about your cattle as one of your key strategies for flexibility in the system. What are some of the other key things or big picture things you do to make sure you're resilient in the face of a drought?
Oh, well, we talked about either maintaining covers or building covers, different strategies with that, whether it's a bit of nitrogen destocking that we just talked about with the cattle. I'm reluctant to compromise the performance of my ewe flock. You know, they skin well over 200%. And even when things are a bit tight, I think these modern sheep now, these fertile sheep of whatever breed, flushing's actually a lot less important now. The genetics are in there, the fertility's locked in. You know, they're relentlessly fertile. I saw someone talking about their sheep the other day. So... But, you know, you do have the ability, I mean, if it's cattle or hog, I mean, so, oh, I tell you, one that comes to mind is not tuck my hoggets. So it's a tough autumn and I haven't got the cover, and the hoggets usually aren't good enough anyway. They haven't got to minimum of 40. So I went 2 or 3 years until this year where I didn't tuck my hoggets because they weren't good enough and I didn't have enough feed. And my feed budgeting told me I was going to be tight in August, September. Well, you know, lambing hoggets at the end of September after a tough winter when you haven't had a rising... You haven't had a rising live weight gain, it's not going to end well. So I make that decision February, March. I'm not going to tuck the hoggets. In fact, I made that decision this year because we had a very tough January, February. And then these cyclones started hitting us and hitting the whole of the North Island and some of the South Island. And I grew the best autumn we've ever had, probably, and certainly one of the wetter ones and one of the wettest winters for 2 or 3 decades. I made a late decision to tuck the hoggets. I gave them Caplobacter, but I couldn't get Toxo, of course, at short notice. So I've taken the risk, and they're just leaving now. And you know, fingers crossed, I've got away with them being exposed to potential of toxoplasmosis. I'll give it to them in 2 days.
And you, I mean, hogget lambing, though, that's the decision at the that's 6 or 8 months before potentially the next drought, you're making the decision to put them in lamb. They're lambing now.
Yeah.
And if you have a dry October, etc.,
yeah.
Is hogget lambing
ready? But I knew I could went by tapping them. By the time I was tapping on, you know, on Anzac Day, 25th of April was my tapping date for hoggets, I knew I had, I could feed these hoggets really well. I suppose if I'm in April and I know my covers are low and I've got rid of a lot of cattle, dry hoggets is one class I can sit on over the winter without doing permanent damage to them later on and then resurrect them.
It's a higher risk, isn't it, in summer dry if they're lambing now and then you have one of those 20 kilo octobers.
Okay. Oh, well, if we're talking hogget management, I think you've talked to Paul Kenyon, so listeners would be better off to listen to Paul Kenyon about hogget management than me. But I mean, you wean early. Don't get greedy with hogget lambing. Wean them, you know, my ewe flock gets weaned, my commercial ewes, on the 21st of November. Studs just after that. And then hoggets probably, you know, certainly on this side of Christmas. So they're quite young. What are we looking at, October, November? So they're 10 weeks old.
And what do you have to wean them onto? It's just safe pasture?
I mean, I usually can, you know, I've got, we didn't talk about quality, but that was all, you know, I assume was sort of understood in terms of my grazing management. But, you know, I can maintain quality usually if I can match my feed demand and my feed supply up. And I usually have good quality pastures up until Christmas, New Year, and then that's when it goes off.
Yep.
So then you've got to prioritise who gets, you know, whether it's chicory paddocks or plantain paddocks and red clover or, you know, or the brassica paddocks. I've got quite a bit of brassica going in because I had 14 hectares worked up to be regrassed. I had 20 worked up. We managed to get 6 in, and the other 14 worked up twice, and we just couldn't get a drill near it. It was so wet. So I've never had winter fallow before, but I thought the plantain would all come back. But all I grew was mousehead, chickweed, and poarania. So I probably grew about 1,000 kilos of dry matter through the winter or two.
They can be pretty good quality in spring.
What
on your ewe performance, you're talking, you're scanning around the 200.
Well above that. Yeah.
With your commercial flock?
Commercial was just over 200.
Yeah.
252, including triplets, of course.
I mean, that level of performance, that level of, you're going to have triplets, a whole lot of twins, I mean, how is that a strength or a weakness in a summer dry environment?
It's a challenge and an opportunity, Aaron. Mm. I mean, you know, this is the great irony about animals, is that we've got sheep now across all the breeds that are quite capable of having triplets. You know, I mean, you know, 30%, my flock has 30-35% triplets in an average to a good year. But they've only got 2 tits.
Uh-huh.
And then you've got cows, the poor old beef guys. They've got cows that can, you know, just do 90% in a good year. And they've got 4 terrific tits hanging there. So there are ewes who will rear 3 quite good lambs. You know, not magnificent lambs, but 32 or 3 kilo average. Over 100 kilos of lamb. Some ewes can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Other ones fail miserably. You know, I mean, usually the weather knocks one out or the last one out or the smallest one doesn't get enough colostrum and Mother Nature tidies it up for you. We've just had people listening who've been through the spring elsewhere, through this winter and spring elsewhere, will find it hard to believe, but I've just had 25 mils of rain since the beginning of August. The tap turned off at the end of July. We're middle of September, 19th of September today doing this. So in 6 weeks, I've had like 20 an inch of rain, 25 mils through my lambing.
Yep.
Didn't lose a single lamb from exposure. First time ever.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got a heck of a big lambing percentage out there with a high scanning and a very low low death rate. So, you know, I've wound back the number of lambs I've booked into the works already. I book in early because I can kill 70% of my commercial lambs, 70-75% off mum, again, because of feed quality, making sure that the ewes have been well fed, have a big udder, the lamb birth weights are 5.5 kilos when they come out. See, people don't realise that. You know, a 5 kilo lamb over a 4 kilo lamb will be 3 kilos heavier at weaning. Just because it had that kilo extra birth weight, hit the ground running.
Yep.
You know, that's you know, low-hanging fruit.
And the key drivers of that difference in birth weight are what? Are
you conditioning? Well, you have a good tupping and you've grown a good placenta, but I tighten my ewes up real fast because I've synchronised them. And bearing control, so in that first trimester I take quite a bit of weight off my ewes, having got them to good weights at tupping. I'm tough, and because of all those little paddocks I can do this quite easily. In fact, I get to mid to late May when I shear them and they get shorn and they go, oh, I might have been a little bit too tough, and then draft out a tail end and sort of look after them a bit better. But it does work in terms of bearing control. I mean, a lot of people had some terrible bearings this year, but they just either weren't able to or didn't take that weight off in the first trimester.
Yes, if you don't, you're not trying to tighten them up in the third trimester.
No, because there. So to answer your question, 4 to 5 weeks out, my ewes are just about ad-libbing. Mm-hmm. They're going into 1,500 kilograms of dry matter and going out at 1,100 or 1,200 mm-hmm. for 4 weeks. They eat a lot of grass. Mm-hmm. You've got to have a lot of grass at the beginning of July to be able to do that. They just motor through it. And, because you can't put any more, I've taken condition off and I've just built them up a little bit through June. I'm not putting any condition on, but I'm growing big birth weight lambs mm-hmm. and building a good size udder full of milk.
And you don't have distocia or bearing issues?
No. Funny enough, when I started doing this 10 or 12 or 14 years ago, it came as a result of sitting next to Peter Gluckman, or Sir mm-hmm. Peter Gluckman he is now. And I was on the board of Land Corp at the time, and we were doing some work with Liggins Institute that he was the head of in Auckland. And we had this really interesting talk over dinner one night, and he told me about... Are we digressing too much here?
No, there's no...
He told me about this thing called epigenetics. Mm. So that was new to me then, and we still don't understand a lot about it. And it's pretty complex. But he told me about in the Netherlands, when the Germans were there and the Dutch revolted, and I forget the year, 1943 or something like that, they just screwed them down. Germans screwed them down, starved them into submission for a very short period of time. And maybe the war ended, and then they were well fed again. And the Dutch, like the Germans, are terrific record keepers. And they've got this little cohort of children that were in utero, and they followed them through their lives. And not surprisingly, they were sick, and they got a lot more cancer than the kids mm-hmm. that were like a year older than them, or a year younger. They were much sicker. And now no one would be surprised with mm-hmm. that. But epigenetics show, or that's what we now know mm-hmm. it as, their children. And their grandchildren were sicker. The genes had... The fetus had been told that the environment was a really tough place out there. And the little switches on the genes can get turned on and off. So we don't know what we're doing in terms of the signals that we're giving our stock and the way we feed them when the ewes are pregnant with the lambs inside. But I just thought at the time, I'll start feeding my ewes. Instead of keeping them half-starved right up to lambing... And then they start falling over with milk fever and sleepy sickness mm-hmm. and, I better feed them well, but God, if I feed them well, I'll get bearings. And you did, because the sudden mm-hmm. change. I'll feed them really well through that, when they really should be fed well, according to the science. And I get a lot less bearings, because I think there's less stress on them, and there's not a sudden feed change.
So just be, how long before lambing you really start putting them on?
End of June. So, and I start lambing at the beginning of August, so it's 4 to 5 weeks.
Yep, that lasts, not quite a full, not a full trimester.
But you've got to have the feed to be able to do it.
Yeah, but you've carried some, because you do tighten them
and
up.
And I don't begrudge the feed I leave behind, when my residuals are 11 or 1200, because I know it's going to be, it's still there when I set stock. So it's not like it's gone.
And at the start, when you're using harnesses on your commercial ewes?
I use harnesses and they'll fetal age now, my mm-hmm. standards, and they're fast and I synchronise. So mm-hmm. I get big rush of lambs right at the start.
So tighten them up, and you'll still get some, I presume. You're just not seeing major problems with bearings and distocia and those sort of things.
Yeah, I mean, what have I got, 1,400 ewes? I think I lost... Five. I might have put five up. I might have saved five.
Yeah.
These people who boast that they can save 100% of bearings or something, I get about 50%. Lambing time, I'm a bit of old. I zip around. I mean, I have to do my studs twice every day. I tag them morning and evening, and I put a ring on the tail so I don't have to dock them as well. So they're all tagged at birth with little EID tags. But the commercial ewes, I'll still flick around them twice a day. Mm-hmm. You roll one cast ewe over. On those sort of feeding levels and the weight of the lambs on board, when I weigh my studs at birth, I mean, I've had triplets, that 18 to 20 kilos at the top end.
Of
live
lamb.
Weight.
Yeah, 3, 6
but,
kilos.
But, quite a few, in that 15, 16, 17, three lambs at 5 kilo, triplet lambs. So they're big size lambs and twins, might be 6 or something. So my commercial ewes, my biggest problem is casting. Mm-hmm. At lambing, at set stocking and lambing, so I'm forced to go around and sometimes a third time zip around at lunchtime and roll a cast ewe over that might be dead later on. So some people listen to that will think, people in certain different types of country don't get the casting, or they aren't able to do that, but I can, And, you know, I just think, guys, it's the easiest $300 ever made. Mm-hmm. When you roll a cast you over, that would have been dead tomorrow morning.
Plus the wall.
So I suppose it's, you know, it's about attention to detail and doing the little things. One thing we didn't talk about that when you were saying we were going to do this talk that I was thinking about, I told you I was an owner-operator, you know, I'm a one-man band, which I enjoy. And the great advantage of that is, you know, I'm the CEO and the general manager and the senior shepherd and stock manager, right down to junior shepherd, you know. So the chain of command and operations like mine and countless others out there is pretty bloody good. So when the junior shepherd, I cocked up a couple of days ago, I put some sheep into a paddock. And when I went to shift them, remembered that I'd planted some trees in there, you know, bloody expensive citrus trees, a couple of citrus trees near the house, lime trees. That I hadn't put a tree guard around. I hadn't got around to doing it. And of course, these things give them a bit of a rack. So the general manager was pretty pissed off with the CEO 2 days ago when I did that.
So that's
a big advantage of us, you know, because we're often written off the smaller farms and things like that. But we have the opportunity to lift our game. And actually, we haven't talked about that.
That's right.
Are we going to tell that story about how I thought this was on a webcam?
Yeah, you might have heard the bit of paper rustling there on the podcast because Steve's got visual aids for a podcast.
I'll talk to it. Yeah, well, you gave me the impression, although when I reread the email, I could see that there was really no such impression. I got the wrong idea that this was some sort of webcast.
That's right, Steve. I'm not paying you, so I'm
not. No, that's true. You bought me dinner, so that was all right. So the graph I've got in front of me is out of the Economic Service from Beef and Lamb, and it's inflation adjusted. It's got $2,004.5, and a lot of people would have seen these graphs, and it's the farm profit per hectare. So it's the EFSs, and you look at it, and there's at the moment, well, in 2015 and 16, there was 19% below $0 a hectare. So, you know,
Making a loss.
19% made a loss in that year a couple of years ago. And what this graph that I'm looking at that no one else can see, but you can easily get it from the Economic Service or from me, if anyone emails me, I'll send it to them. It's got the 1990 to 91 EFSs, bell-shaped curve, and they're in green, and then it's got the 2015 and 16. Back in 1991, we were much more compact. But now we look at this, and you've got the sort of normal bell-shaped curve there in 2015 and 16. But what's really interesting is it continues out and then it goes back up again. You don't normally see that in these sort of bell-shaped curves. And at the top end there, and we're talking about, above $600 a hectare EFS, and this is before tax and drawings and capital expenditure. In fact, there's a big blip there of over 650. You know, there's 4%, 4%. So this I reckon, is the most interesting thing in sheep and beef in terms of information. There's this little group, and you know, I'll put myself in there. In fact, I'm one of the farmers that they monitor. I think it's about 5% of all sheep and beef farmers are part of the Economic Service survey. This group of farmers here are employing technology and all the stuff that we've been talking about, Aaron, to good effect.
Yeah.
And they're making good money. You know, they're making $600,000, $700,000, $800,000, $900,000 EFSs. So that means they're grossing, you know, let's say they're spending 50%, they're grossing $1,500 to $2,000 out of sheep and beef. And this is not just on the good country, this is across all land classes, you know. That's on harder hill country and some better stuff. But these aren't cropping or finishing or dairy operations, and yet they're getting 6% return on capital. That's the secret success story of New Zealand agriculture, is that little group. And the great thing is they're exemplars. You know, there's a whole lot of people here in the middle that we could shift up, and we could shift these guys who are making losses, because there's no future in that, can move them up there if they only employed some of the techniques that we've been talking about and that you regularly talk about.
So we will link to this so you can see what Steve's talking about. Hopefully a number of you have. It's the two distribution curves about 25 years apart. Yep, and showing how the mean has moved a bit, but particularly at that top end now, we've got a bimodal distribution, they call it?
Is that the word? Oh, bimodal.
That sounded good, didn't it?
It did sound good.
So there's a spike at the top end. There's another graph we'll link to as well that goes with that one, that which went into the analysis and showed they're not getting that because they've got secret sweetheart deals with meat companies. Their lamb price is not...
I haven't got one of those.
Haven't you? No.
But if anyone who's listening knows how to get one, let me know.
They exist, apparently. I've heard absolutely, people swear that they exist, but I've yet to come across one in real life. But anyway, the people at that top end, or the farms with the higher levels of profit, weren't getting some sort of miraculous price per kilo. It was lamb sold per hectare was the difference, and that's the productivity, how many were going out the gate, which is what we're about today. So the key issue out of all this, I think, if I can sum it up, is it's not about waiting for silver bullets out of research. The stuff's there already. It's applying it and adopting it and making it work on farm.
Can I just finish with one last thing?
Oh, we're not finished yet.
Oh, we're not finished. Have you got some questions?
If you don't mind.
Okay, carry on.
So the one thing I wanted to talk about, and you have touched on it, which has played a big part in this, is the three S's: subdivision, stocking, super. But sheep breeding and breeding better sheep, you've talked on that you're a real advocate and a believer in the system, and it works. So I just wanted to drill into that a wee bit, if you don't mind, Steve, if I can ask you a question. Breeding better sheep, what is a better sheep in your view? What have you been selecting for and breeding for?
Well, I mean, ideally, you know, we're talking ewes, it's going to be rearing two lambs at 35 to 38 kilograms after 12 or 13 weeks. It's great, you know, dual purpose, it's growing wool, you know, wool's in the doldrums, it's improved a little bit lately, but, you know, for better or worse, we've been increasing the wool that grows on these sheep. The sheep, you know, goes for 5 or 6 years. She's sound. She's got a good mouth, good feet, and she goes the distance. So you know, that would be that. And these sheep are out there, and these genetics are out there.
So triplets, though, would you try and breed away from triplets, or do you just accept?
Well,
the trouble
is with fertility. You know, those of us who've been breeding for a long time. You know, I mean, our place have been performance recording now for 45 years, and others have been doing the same length of time or a bit longer. Tony Parker at the Sheep Awards got recognised. He'd been doing it for 50. We've been breeding for fertility, and it is a bit of a straight line. And there's some work looking at trying to find rams that have a lower triplet rate, because that would be ideal. Because I said to you, you know, triplets are, I mean, you know, they are an opportunity and a challenge, but they, you know, a bit of a pain in the ass on hill country. And that's why I said the ideal sheep was twins. So no, I'm not trying to get the triplet, you know, triplet rate that I've just had this year. But it's just a function of fertile sheep with a good flushing and a good tupping. And then the other thing is disease, building some tolerance in for disease. Yep. So I'm in an area that gets facial eczema sometimes. It's not a constant threat. But I'm on a hot farm, so I've been breeding for 12 or 15 years for facial eczema tolerance. And more and more breeders are starting to do that. There's only about 18 of us, I think, of the FE Gold brand, which means we're testing them at 0.6, doing 10% of our sale rams, and been doing it, I think it's for 10 years or longer.
Yeah, so when you talk 0.6, that's the challenge.
That's
the toxin.
Yeah, and that's a brutal challenge. It's like, I forget what it equates to, something like a million spores. That's a pretty brutal challenge. I mean, ideally, we'd be doing this with DNA markers and things like that, but it looks like it's, I forget what the word is, but it's over a whole lot of genes. So there's no easy single markers. So hopefully that would be a better test, and we'll get to that at some stage.
What have you seen in the tolerance of your commercial flock or your sheep? And you know, you've been, how long do you say you've been? 15?
I'd been using FE tolerant genes before that, but I've been doing the Ramguard test, I think, for 12 or 13 years.
You've seen a marked.
Like 2 years ago, it was a really high challenge here. We got into the hundreds of thousands for a few weeks, and I did nothing. I started to get pretty nervous. And I actually got a few clinicals, a handful, like six or eight clinicals, and there was a definite production loss. My dry rate's normally around that 1% to 2%, and it was 4% or something like that. So those sheep they weren't clinicals. They didn't look affected, but it had definitely affected their tupping. So, no, this has been, you know, it's another good bit of science that has worked. You know, my mates and peers who've been doing this for 20 or 30 years, their sheep are pretty bulletproof. Their cattle get facial eczema real bad. You know, there's no tolerance in if they've got Friesian bulls or whatever like that. But their sheep are, you know, they're not, it's not 100%. Because we're talking about genes and genetics, and the ram bringing half the genes, and the ewe bringing half, and the hereditability is quite high in the FE tolerance thing. But so you know, you can't guarantee it, but it has worked. And then there's other people doing the, and I'm not doing it because it's really hard. The more things you do, the less progress you make on things. But people are doing, you know, looking at worm tolerance and worm resistance. So that's, you know, it's all got to be good for the long-term sustainability for sheep.
So you're a ram, you said the caveat is you're a ram breeder and you're selling rams. Yeah, we're away again. Sorry, the phone just rang, which is unusual. What was the question I was going to... Oh, right, ram breeding. I mean, you're a ram breeder, you're selling rams, and you gave that caveat. So what have you seen on your own farm that gives you, you know, such faith and confidence that the SIL system, Sheep Improvement Limited, is actually working?
Yeah, well, in terms of the performance, you know, we talked about trying to get all your ducks in a row and, you know, lifting your game in terms of the infrastructure and what, and growing more grass and more quality grass. And then having those genetics. So you kind of get those genetics to express themselves without all that other stuff. But I am seeing it in my stock and in my client's stock. You know, I've got clients scanning over 200% commercial guys. They're a little bit stunned and staggered and a bit nervous, but they've had a good landing. And I see it in my peers, you know, in Kick West, but also Romney's. You know, there's good sheep out there. And when fed properly, and when, you know, when the climate behaves itself and the season goes well, there are some bloody good results out there in terms of sheep performance. So the genetics are there. I mean, you know, the great thing, I mean, I haven't been selecting for fertility for some years. It's a lowly hereditable trait. So you'd have to actively select against it for probably 10 or 20 years to make it go down. So it means you can take the foot off the accelerator there and just, you know, I concentrate in my own stud now in terms of survival. There's no point in having a whole lot of lambs if you're not breeding for survival. So survival is a key growth, and I'm doing a bit on meat as well in terms of ultrasound, you know, ultrasound scan, all my ram hoggets and CT scan a few. But I'm not trying to turn what's a dual purpose sheep into a terminal, because that's where my terminals come in.
Yep.
So I'm also a commercial guy. So I go on to the Silace site, and I want to kill, I've talked about that, 70-75% of my lambs off mum at 12-13 weeks of age. So I went on there a number of years ago to see who's got the best 100-day growth rate. And I completely changed my breed away from where I was getting them to Pole Dorsets from Glengarry, and get their rams, because the science says that that's what they do really well. They do other stuff well too, but I just go down to their auction and I cherry pick out the 100-day growth rate rams, and I'm buying stud rams, competing against stud breeders, but they're actually more interested. They want the meat and the growth. So I get these sort of big ranging, fast-growing things who grow fast lambs, because my meat company doesn't reward me for carcass composition. They're not giving me that market signal. Well, my lambs look pretty good when they go on the truck.
Heavy.
But I've got to get rid of them. That's another one of the techniques about dry. I've just got to make sure, if I'm going to put a lot of lambs on the ground at weaning, I've got to get out of them one way or another, so I kill them. And finish the balance.
So there's two things there. I mean, with a breed like that, you're probably still getting some pretty good carcasses anyway, even though you tend to be selecting individual rams. But, I mean, you read the theory, you bought the rams based on it. Did you see an actual impact on farm?
Yeah, because I had four of my previous rams and four of theirs, then I was able to monitor it. And it taught me that the move I was making was the right one. Yep. So I got another four and got rid of those. Fellas went to the dogs.
Done.
Sort of. There's nothing wrong with my previous ones, it's just that these were better for what I needed.
Yeah.
So everyone else has got, you know, there'd be other people listening who, no way on their type of country can, you know, they'd be lucky if they can kill 10 or 20%. And they might have a wet summer, so they have the ability to be able to finish lambs, you know, in the autumn, or maybe they have a winter lamb policy. I don't know, I'm out of lambs by, all my commercial lambs are dead by March, April.
All right, look, just looking at time, we've gone a long way and we've sort of come full circle, I think, through your farming year. But you talked about, I don't know if there's anything else in particular you want to cover, Steve?
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, that sort of, not folksy thing, but the good feel thing. You know, I want to talk about land ownership.
Yep.
You know, so I see it's a privilege, it's not a right. I mean, and it's only a life tenure anyway, you don't take it with you. But, you know, I've always farmed as though, you know, I'll live forever. And hopefully live life as though you might die tomorrow. So, you know, and that would be a lot. Most people listening would see it like that. You know, our farms, our family farms, they're our two-runga wai wai. you know, the place where we stand. Mm-hmm. You know, they are pretty special. And, you know, a lot of commentators write off the small, I suppose here I'm not doing a pitch for the small farm, mm-hmm. but, you know, we get written off a lot, but we're bloody resilient buggers because it is home as well as our business. So, that you know, we are bloody privileged to have that opportunity to have own land.
Mm.
You know, a lot of the world doesn't have that. A lot of people in the world don't have the opportunity and things like that. And so most of us aren't doing the right thing by our land and mm-hmm. leaving it better than we found it. And, you know, and now we've got this challenge, you know, coming at us in terms of protecting, you know, the wetlands and the rivers and things. And we're just going to have to do it. Because it's not going to get, that pressure's not going to go away.
Yeah.
You know, we're in Plan Change 6 here in the Tuketuk catchment in Hawke's Bay. So we are now seeing what the guys with Horizons and what the Waikato guys are a bit behind us are grappling with. This is going to happen all around the country. So, you know, stop ranting and railing about it and start working out how to do it. And you know, sometimes as cheaply as you can because mm-hmm. people won't have the ability to do it, you know, economically or do it the right way. I mean, a lot of satisfaction, you know, I look, because I started doing riparian plantings 10, 15 years ago and it's really satisfying.
Mm.
And protecting a few little wetlands, or creating wetlands, I don't really have any to protect. Creating a few little wetlands. It's really, really neat. And now it is the most satisfying part of my farming day, is going around looking at what I've done and planted and created. It's really cool. So no, I'm lucky, I'm fortunate. I've loved farming and I've enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still enjoying it. And you know, I've got a good wife and three good sons. And yeah, I'm very happy.
Money's not the driver, but it is easier to enjoy farming when you're putting things in place and making a few dollars at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's right.
Good. All right. Hey, look, on that note, just looking at how long we've been going and how long I've still got questions I haven't covered off, and I suspect this people that are listening to this are going, why don't you ask them about X, Y, Z, but we could be here all night. So, look, I'm going to wrap up on that note. We've covered a fair bit of stuff. It's been fairly wide-ranging. I thought it might, so... Steve Wynne-Harris, thanks very much for coming on the call.
Thank you very much, Aaron. Thanks for asking me.